So somewhere in the neighborhood of fiscal year 2021, the earnings reserve would be depleted, and at that point in time, there wouldn't be any dividends.
The potential cost to Alaskans if lawmakers can't agree on a fiscal plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 14th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski's interior appropriations bill gives Democrats some heartburn.
We are not prepared to gut environmental laws as the price of getting spending bills passed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Since the Senate passed a bill last week that would draw money from the permanent fund to pay for state government, two things have happened. One is that many Alaskans have raised concerns with the part of the bill that would cut permanent fund dividends in half. The other is that the bill was sent to the House, where it's having a harder time moving. In fact, it might not even get out of the Finance Committee. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau has been following the bill's progress. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
Andrew, what's stopping the bill?
There's two different things going on. On the one hand, some conservative Republican members say they can't justify cutting the PFD without making deeper cuts to state government. For example, North Pole Representative Tammy Wilson says Governor Bill Walker should veto at least $500 million.
Are conservative members saying what exactly they'd like to see cut?
Some would like to stop pay raises for government workers. And there are other items that were added to the budget before it passed that they wanted to have cut. But it's tough to get these numbers to add up to a large share of the $3-plus billion deficit.
And what about the Democrats?
They also aren't happy. They don't want to tell voters that they cut their PFDs without making deeper cuts to oil and gas tax credits. They're also concerned about a part of the bill that could limit revenue. But Walker administration officials explained more details about that section that made it clear that the revenue limit isn't as strong as some lawmakers feared. For example, it wouldn't start until oil and gas revenues reach $1.2 billion, which is projected not to happen in the next 10 years. And as oil production falls, it will also be less of an issue.
So who is for the bill?
Well, the Walker administration and some legislators who say cutting PFDs now would make the dividends more likely to continue into the future. The state has two savings accounts. The Constitutional Budget Reserve is the one that's usually used to close state budget deficits. The problem is there's only about $7 billion left, and the state's deficit is over $3 billion. So without changes, within 2 years, the state government would start to draw on the other savings account, which is permanent fund earnings. And there's only about $8 billion there. State Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck explained the problem.
By fiscal year 2018, the CBR would be depleted, and that we would start drawing down on the permanent fund earnings reserve. That's anticipated that that would last a little bit more than two additional years. So somewhere in the neighborhood of fiscal year 2021, the earnings reserve would be depleted, and at that point in time, there wouldn't be any dividends.
So he makes the case that the state must cut the PFD in order to save it.
All right, Andrew, the special session that started 3 weeks ago is scheduled to end next Tuesday. What happens if the House doesn't pass the permanent fund restructuring bill?
Governor Walker is likely to call another special session in June now, but many legislators aren't eager to spend more of the summer here, so they might gavel out without taking up the bill. That could set up a situation in which the state government draws more than $3 billion from the Constitutional Budget Reserve this year without a long-term fiscal plan. And it's a situation that Governor Walker said he won't accept. Finance Committee Co-Chairman Republican Steve Thompson of Fairbanks says many people have focused on the threat of an immediate cut, but aren't as aware of the long-term threat to PFDs.
If we don't cap it at this time, in 3 to 4, 5 years, maybe at the most, the earnings will be gone and the permanent fund will go to zero. They'll have no dividend check.
Thompson would like to see a compromise on the bill this week, and the Finance Committee is meeting to hear public testimony on the bill tonight.
All right. Thanks for that update, Andrew.
Thank you, Lori.
The third major credit ratings agency has weighed in on Alaska's fiscal health. New York-based Fitch Ratings announced this morning that it is lowering the state's long-term credit rating from a AAA, its highest rating, to AA+, citing the state's massive budget gap. It follows downgrades earlier this year from the other two major ratings agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's Investors Service. The credit downgrades will make it more expensive for the state to borrow money in the future. All three agencies have said they expect Alaska's rating to slip lower if oil prices remain low and the state continues to rely solely on savings to cover the deficit. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski had a chance to flex some legislative muscle today. As chair of an appropriations subcommittee, Murkowski writes the legislation that sends money to the Department of the Interior, the EPA, and the Forest Service, and tells them how to spend it. Her subcommittee passed that bill today. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski also loaded it down with several of her favorite environmental policy changes, which Senate Democrats are calling poison pills.
Good morning. A call to order. The Interior and Related Agencies Subcommittee markup.
Murkowski says she'll never stop trying to get a road for King Cove to link the community to an all-weather airport. The senator says her bill authorizes a land trade to allow for a road through a portion of the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge.
I recognize the need to protect the environment, but recognize that it should not come at the expense of jeopardizing the lives of those that I represent.
That's an example of a rider, a policy change a lawmaker slips into another bill, sometimes completely unrelated. Another of Murkowski's Alaska-specific riders would stop the feds from imposing stricter predator hunting rules in the state's national wildlife refuges. The $32 billion bill has several big national riders, like one that would block an EPA rule defining which waters are subject to the Clean Water Act. Another halts a stream buffer protection rule that mine advocates say would kill coal mining in Alaska and around the country. Murkowski says her bill pinches the EPA's regulatory budget in areas where she says the agency has overstepped its bounds.
Several program areas that have issued controversial rules that are currently blocked in court are reduced, because I believe it's more important to provide resources to programs that yield tangible results in improving the environment instead of funding more lawyers and bureaucrats to draft rules of questionable legality and dubious environmental benefit.
The top Democrat on her subcommittee, Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico, says he likes that the bill increases money for drinking water infrastructure and the Indian Health Service. But Udall says he can't support it.
We are not prepared to gut environmental laws as the price of getting spending bills passed.
Among the riders Udall counts as a poison pill are changes to logging rules in the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. Exactly what the bill says on that is unknown. Murkowski did not make the document public, but she and Udall issued summaries. The bill itself is scheduled for release on Thursday when it goes before the full Senate Appropriations Committee. Udall says that's when he'll try to remove the parts he doesn't like. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska could receive up to $4 million in federal funding to increase access to opioid addiction treatment options. It's part of the Obama administration's $1.1 billion nationwide plan to fight the epidemic. According to a White House press release, the amount is determined by the severity of the local problem and the strategies each community has to respond to it. Alaska ranks 20th nationwide for drug poisoning death rates. Congress has not yet approved the spending. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, helping out a bear in a tight spot.
We used some tin snips to open up the opening enough that we could slide it off its head.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Association of Village Council Presidents has confirmed the organization's troubles with near bankruptcy, questionable financial investments, and three pending audits. KYUK's Adrian Wagner reports.
Wednesday, June 8th, tribal leaders from across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta came together for what many thought was a long-overdue discussion on the state of AVCP's finances. Harold Napoleon, tribal delegate and former AVCP president, says the organization is like a sinking ship without a captain.
It should be of a very great concern to the Yupik people, the condition and the shape that AVCP is in.
Napoleon says that the board chairman told delegates that AVCP came close to bankruptcy in November of 2015, but neglected to inform their board of directors until last week. During December of 2015, a month later, the organization laid off 30 of its employees. They cited, quote, current economic trends, unquote, as their reason in a press release. These layoffs happened just months after the organization received more than $9 million in a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice. Last week's meeting is the first time that the full board has met since then, after administration canceled February's meeting. A delay which Napoleon says was admitted by the chairman to be intentional.
He admitted that they were withholding information. They were withholding information from their own board members.
During that time, Napoleon says that other groups have taken interest in the matter.
They told their board members that they were undergoing audits. They admitted that.
Napoleon says that AVCP is being investigated by at least three different auditors, but he says that the executive board did not tell delegates which companies were doing the auditing. The audits come after a series of leaked emails in January of 2016 revealed AVCP mishandled federal grants to fund administrative salaries, and at least $1 million went from the AVCP TANF account to fund the company's flight school. TANF is a federal program to help needy families with strict spending regulations. A flight school would be outside those guidelines, and AVCP had been warned it was against the rules.
But they did not deny it. They agreed, yes, they did take TANF funds and use them for the flight school.
Despite months of waiting, Napoleon says delegates still don't have the whole picture.
They were not able to provide numbers because their chief financial officer was not there.
The biggest unknown, Napoleon says, was who authorized the reallocation of TANF funds, as well as investments in real estate like the now-closed Athlonovic Hotel. Napoleon says that the administration told delegates they didn't know who signed off on these deals. These admissions come just a month after AVCP President Myron Nanning retired. Nanning made no indication of AVCP's financial trouble in an interview discussing his retirement with Alaska Dispatch News, but Napoleon says he must have known.
He's been president for 24 years. As president, he knew or should have known all this information in those 24 years. But I can't say that he knew specifically where every penny was, but he was the president.
These announcements are deeply concerning for the future of the organization, says Napoleon.
I think, as someone who's been around AVCP since its inception, that I believe that the organization is lost, and it affects the health and well-being of all of our people, because it's the instrument that we created to advance our causes and our concerns. If it's lost, then we, in a sense, we are lost.
KYUK spoke with two other delegates who confirmed the accuracy of Napoleon's statements, but who didn't want to go on record. Myron Nanning did not respond to phone calls for comment. AVCP Acting President Mike Hoffman declined to comment, and AVCP Board Chairman Henry Hunter declined to comment as well. In Bethel, I'm Adrian Wagner.
Anchorage police have released the name of the man critically injured last week in a suspected moose attack. Police say the injured man is 50-year-old Fred Mayak. Anchorage television station KTUU reports Department of Fish and Game officials are waiting to interview him until his condition improves. Mayak was found on June 8th, bleeding from multiple wounds near Campbell Creek Estuary Park. Police at first suspected he had been stabbed, but medics said the nature of his injuries indicated he may have been attacked by a bear. But state wildlife officials found no indication of a bear mauling. They say it's more likely Mayak was attacked by a moose. Mountaineers, morticians, and a forensic anthropologist are scouring the surface of a glacier as they hunt for the remains of a military plane that crashed 64 years ago. After the C-124 Globemaster crashed on its flight from Washington to Alaska in November 1952, the wreckage was quickly covered by ice and snow, hampering recovery efforts. But in 2012, debris from the crash was spotted. And in the years since, crews have worked to identify remains. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the elaborate, dangerous recovery process is about bringing closure to families even six decades later.
It's a 20-minute helicopter ride from Joint Base Zehlendorf-Richardson past gray-blue spires of ice and rock to the excavation site. An 11-person crew works 6 days a week methodically searching this corner of the Colony Glacier for remnants of the crash.
We want to clear the debris off for one. More importantly, we're looking for our service members that were killed in this incident.
Alan Cronin is a chief within the Air Force's Mortuary Affairs Operations based in Dover, Delaware. And though he's used to investigating crashes, Cronin says this mission remains unique.
Well, they don't have glaciers in Delaware.
Oversight of the project was shifted over to the Air Force last year, and many of the individuals working here today were given special training to help deal with the difficulties and nuances of the setting. The glacier preserved a lot of the wreckage, but the decades of constant internal churning pulverized the physical remains.
It's difficult. Different from other recoveries because it's ever-changing. It's not like in a forest. The trees are not moving. Here, it's ever-changing. 3 days ago, it looked different.
Cronin points to the humps and troughs that have shifted since the crew restarted work this month. The amount of organic matter required to identify someone is 3 grams, about the weight of 3 small paperclips. With dozens of service members killed in the crash, Cronin says this is the biggest recovery operation he's worked on.
52 people was on board that aircraft. We have identified 32. We obviously will continue until we get all 52.
Cronin says that work will take at least another 2 years. It's expensive and it's dangerous. Even though my visit lasted just an hour, it required a safety briefing, crampons for walking around, along with a harness and an ice pick in case I fell into a crevasse. And this is considered a safe spot on the glacier. Captain Jason Collier is the planner in charge of coordinating all the different pieces of this mission and says the dangers are mitigated by all the training and precautions that go into it. He insists that the risks are justified and the possibility of closure 6 decades later has a value greater than symbolism.
The families are very much, you know, in touch and they are all very vigilant on this. There's still 20 members that have not been identified and they're hoping to get their family members back. Some of them are, you know, a 1 or 2 year old daughter's son whose father perished. So yeah, it definitely brings closure.
Back at J-Bear, one such family member waits for word on recovery of her relative. Tanya Anderson Dell never met her grandfather, Airman Isaac William Anderson Sr., who was just 21 when the Globemaster went down. She started asking politicians and members of the military about recovery efforts in 2001.
My grandmother, she had said to me that she was ready for a flag, and that's because she'd already knew he wasn't coming home, and she was dying at that time. And so I just started writing letters and just wanted to know, had they gone back, had they find them, you know, found the men and stuff like that. So just pushing, looking for closure, bringing these men home.
Anderson Dell is an intermediary between the military and families still seeking some finality. Though she lives in Florida, she's come up to Alaska before at her own expense in order to stay involved with the recovery efforts. Since nearly all the personnel working on the glacier are new this year, Anderson Dell wants to keep long-waiting relatives in the minds of those doing the chilly work of forensic archaeology.
And I want to be able to tell the team that, you know, give them support. Here's a family member, here's a face. So you guys, when you go out there, you kind of know when you're looking for these soldiers, it's because of that person you met down there on the ground.
They haven't found remains for Anderson Dell's grandfather yet. She says it's an emotional roller coaster each time a new ID is made, but that she'll stay involved until all 52 lives are accounted for.
And now that these men are coming home, it's going to be closure. That final piece to bring in that last member of their family home.
Recovery operations on the glacier will continue until the end of the month if conditions remain safe. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Anchorage Fire Department is warning of dangerous fire conditions. The department says dry conditions exist and warm, dry weather is forecast in south-central Alaska for the next 3 days. Dry, gusty wind forecast for tonight could make the threat worse. All burning is suspended in the municipality. The department says people should use extreme caution with fire until conditions moderate. The department is also warning private pilots and drone operators to stay at least 5 miles away from all wildfires.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
A crowd of more than 50 Sitkans gathered in Totem Square last night to honor the 49 victims of Sunday's shooting at Pulse, an Orlando nightclub. Organized by Sitka resident Hannah Guggenheim, the group gathered beneath a blue sky in a big circle and, holding strips of orange paper, took turns reading the 49 names aloud. KCAW's Emily Kwong was there and spoke with Guggenheim.
There was events in D.C. and in New York and all around the country, but nothing had happened quite yet in Sitka, and I just thought, well, let's just think of a date, set it. So Monday seemed like a good time for us, for everybody to get together right after work, and just posted it on Sitka Chatters.
Jean Nieves Rodriguez, 27 years old.
Frank Hernandez, 27 years old.
Angel L. Candelario Pedro, 28 years old.
Antonio Devone Brown, 29 years old.
Eddie Jameldroy Justice, 30 years old.
Enrique L. Rios Jr., 25 years old.
Yesterday I couldn't breathe. I stayed under my covers and watched the images on Facebook and TV over and over.
My name is Debbie Terry, and I've lived in Orlando for 30 years. The club was new since I left, but I actually know the woman that started it after her brother. The name is Pulse to represent the heartbeat of her brother who died of HIV, and just to continue a safe, lively place for people to go to and feel safe.
I live in Washington, D.C. I'm going to get on a plane tomorrow and go home to my husband and my dog, who I'm looking forward to seeing very much, especially my dog. And I'm just so appreciative that this happened here, that this vigil happened here. I needed something like this.
More people spoke, and then Hannah Guggenheim brought out 49 white tea lights for people to take home, but not before the group laid them in the grass in the formation of a heart.
My heart is just with youth and people in our community who want to be here today at this event, but don't feel safe in our community, coming out to their friends and family, don't feel comfortable. And I just hope that we can do what we can here to make this community more welcoming, more genuinely welcoming.
Voices of Sitka residents honoring the victims of the Orlando shooting. State officials came to the aid of a bear with a can stuck on its head along the Alaska Highway yesterday. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Tokyo-area Alaska Department of Fish and Game assistant biologist Jeff Wells says the agency and state troopers were notified about the bear Monday morning by drivers who spotted it along the Alcan about 15 miles outside town.
Started receiving calls that a black bear had a old metal coffee can stuck around its head.
Wells says the bear drew the attention of several drivers in what he describes as a remote spot near the Taylor Highway turnoff. He says the bear, a small adult male, had taken refuge under a tractor trailer when Fish and Game arrived on scene.
It was laying off the side of the road under the semi, and we were able to dart it while it was laying under there. We used some tin snips to open up the opening enough that we could slide it off its head.
Wells says the bear did not suffer any injuries, woke up and walked away after the can was removed and the tranquilizer had worn off. He describes the incident as very rare, adding it's unclear where the empty metal coffee can came from, cautioning people not to leave out food containers, which can attract bears. He also underscores the importance of leaving wildlife rescues up to professionals, noting that a concerned citizen reportedly tried to remove the can from the bear before Fish and Game arrived on scene. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholz, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Adrian Wagner in Bethel, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.